Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, это Prevail. И ваш ведущий Грег Олиер.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show today. The journalist and author Nina Burley is here. She wrote a great book called Virus, which is about the virus and vaccines and the response to the virus. And we have a pretty long, interesting, far-ranging conversation about all kinds of stuff like that, which is, I keep saying interesting and fascinating. And I feel like I listen back to these things and I think, don't you know any other words? People on Twitter think you have this big vocabulary, and all I can say is interesting, fascinating. I sound like Trump with his big, tremendous, very big, very tremendous. But, you know, what are you going to do? Something else happened this week, which I'm excited about. To record the introductions in these podcasts, I have this microphone called a Snowball Ice. It looks like a softball, basically, and you plug it into your laptop and the little red light comes on. And I've been using this and talking into this microphone with the little red light, and I watch as it's recording and I can see that it's working. But my producer's like, I can't really hear you very well. Is there something you're doing? You know, the Zoom interviews are much louder than the intro. And I'm like, well, I have the microphone. The light is on. I don't know. Well, come to find out, I didn't hit the right button, and it wasn't the microphone that I thought it was. Even though the red light is on, it was the internal laptop microphone, which is pretty crummy. So that was a problem, and the problem has now been fixed. So hopefully from now on, you'll be able to hear these intros a little bit better. You'll be able to hear my voice better, and the cars as they drive by, and possibly one of my cats if he comes in and starts yelling at me to feed him as I'm talking. Today is Tuesday as I'm recording this. It's after lunch. It's about 1:15 p.m. in the afternoon on Tuesday, June 29th. And I mention this because the podcast comes out on Friday, which is, you know, after Tuesday by a couple days. And this is the week that we think maybe Trump Org is going to be indicted by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, Cy Vance. That may happen. It may not happen this week. I don't know. Part of me wants to wait a little while and see, but then I'm like, what am I going to say? I'm just going to be like, great, you got indicted. And I would play I Fought the Law and the Law Won, but I don't even think I'm allowed to do that, even though that's like the greatest song. Not the Clash version, the Bobby Fuller 5 version. That's as good as it gets, that stuff. Really great song. So if and when indictments do come down, I do plan on cranking that song up, doing a little dance, and I hope you will too. Either way, it doesn't change the fact that Nina and I had a really interesting conversation, which I'm going to share with you right now.
Sunday, one day only. Get ready in Wellington, Ohio for the biggest MAGA Cup rally of the year. This Sunday, the nation's most important venue, Lorain County Fairgrounds, is going to explode. When two of the world's greatest Americans join forces to make America great again, it's the Queen of Mean, Marge Taylor Greene, and the 45th and current president of the United States, the Speed King himself, Donald John Trump. Catch every logic-twisting, Kool-Aid-drinking, dignity-depriving, soul-destroying moment. Don't miss Lock Her Up. Stop the Steal. Fake news. Hunter Biden's laptop. It's Donald Trump at the world-famous Lorain County Fairgrounds in Wellington, Ohio. Get your tickets now, 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 or there'll be no more literal tears left to drink. Act right now, and we'll give you, absolutely free, a MAGA Cuck Rally trucker cap and the Delta Variant. And now, back to Prevail!
Okay, I'm here with Nina Burley. How are you, Nina? Thanks for coming on Prevail Podcast.
I'm great, Greg. Thank you for having me.
We were talking before I hit record that I pronounce your name correctly, which is just this Burley, like, you know, Burley, like big and strong, and that everybody else pronounces it wrong. In fact, I was talking to Lincoln's Bible one time, and she was like, oh, Nina Burley. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure it's Burley. So, yes. It's Burley. And I'm like, I think it's Burley. So it is Burley.
You know why you got it right and they don't? We're English majors. And we know that that's like how it sounds. And I've heard, so I finally put the pronunciation on my Twitter handle. It started to annoy me so much because I'm not a Burley. I'm Burley, like a football player.
Burley is pretty classy sounding though, but as somebody who is constantly having his last name mispronounced, yes. Everybody wants me to be Irish. They desperately want me to be Irish. I am
right.
I'm one of the few people in New Jersey who has not a single drop of Irish blood. So, you know, I'm Italian and I'm Eastern European. And that's,
you absolutely sure of that?
I think there's a trace amount of Welsh. Yes, I did the
23andMe. You might have to do that. You did. Okay.
I did 23andMe. So now they know where I am all the time. They've given my DNA to Bill Gates to put in the microchip that I now
have. Good. You're ahead of the game. Then you don't have to be vaccinated for it.
That's right. Well, I wouldn't get vaccinated. No, I'm kidding. Of course.
we shouldn't even joke about it.
I know. We
they're going to pick that up. That's going to be a little
quote. Just be aggregated. Don't aggregate this.
On Reddit.
So my first question to you is, I've known you now for probably a year, and you've written this, you've written that, you've written two books in the time that I've known you, which feels like a short period of time, and you're constantly, you're doing columns, you're doing this. I crank out three columns a week and you make me feel lazy. So what's going on with you?
No, Greg, that's not actually what's going on here. You are prolific. I am in awe of the number of excellent columns that you've been writing. I did not write two books in 1 year. The Trump Women book I wrote in 2017, 2018-ish. And what you saw was the publication of the paperback with some kind of revisions. I had changed some things or made a new preface to it. So, and then this other book, it's very, very short. It is, the standard book, commercial nonfiction is like 100,000 words or 125,000 words, like 250 pages. And this is only 50,000 words. It's five short reported essays. And it was very easy to write. I mean, there were parts of it that required, I had an assistant helping me with the science, a biological engineering PhD student at Stanford, super smart young woman.
She did
genetics for dummies for me all the time and actually just really was unbelievably helpful. But most of it, and this would be the case for you too, I think, the part that wasn't, there are two parts that have to do with the vaccines. We can talk about that, the vaccine and the vaccine history. The part about the former guy and what they did to the public during the pandemic, it wrote itself. I was waiting to write that down. You and I, we've all watched what they did with our jaws dropping further every day. And we weren't, you may have been writing about it as it happened, but I wasn't so much. And I just felt it needed to be told. And actually when the publisher called and said, I want a book about the vaccines and I want it quickly, I said, I'll write you the book about the vaccines and how they came to be. But you got to let me write about two things, what the government did, how they mishandled it, how they treated the CDC and the data and the science, And then where all of these conspiracy theories came from, starting with it's just the flu, it's a hoax, to Bill Gates and the microchips in the vaccines, and going beyond that.
Now, the book which you have mentioned now, which we were talking about, the title is Virus, and then the long subtitle, Vaccinations, the CDC, and the Hijacking of America's Response to the Pandemic. And I read it. It's really, really good, because it's one of these things where, yes, we saw it in real time, but there's so much stuff happening in real time. And at that time in real time, nobody really knew what was going on, and people were terrified or trying to figure out what was going on, not in a journalistic way, but in a, oh shit, am I going to have enough toilet paper way? Like on, I think, March 11th, the NBA canceled the season or suspended the season. And I saw that on Twitter at 10:20 at night. And I got my car keys and I got some bags and I went to the grocery store and I came home with like $300 worth of like soap and all this stuff. And my kids were making fun of me, and they stopped making fun of me soon after that. You know, they said,
well, because March 12th is when they kicked them out of school. I remember that as that was when it got serious here. I mean, we were, you know, the kids were sent home. We got an email from the one who was up at boarding school in upstate New York saying, come get your kid within 24 hours. Oh, God. It's done. You know, we're out of here. You're out. And that was when it got real. And then, yeah, of course, we came up here on the Delaware and in Sullivan County, and the local grocery store was out of yeast already.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
And there's a Walmart not too far away. And, you know, we went over there and stocked up, and then we didn't come out for, you know, we didn't see people for a month or two. Right. We bought candles in case things were going to go dark. I mean, you just didn't know. But the thing is, we watched what was happening. We watched it on, you know, we still all had internet. We could see the former guy doing his nightly press conferences. You could hear Cuomo and the governors begging for help. You could see the snicker on the face of the former guys. He said, you know, maybe if you were more grateful to me, I could help you. Or, you know, price is always an issue. You need to compete with each other. And everything that was happening was so outrageous. And so that the next thing that would happen would sort of wipe out the last thing that happened.
Right,
you couldn't believe what they were doing. So what I tried to do here, and I think it's hopefully a service to historians and to people really who just want to know, is I cut through the fog of what we were feeling, the panic and all that, because I could sit down now. I wrote this in December, January, February of this year, and write about just what was going on. There was a lot of great daily reporting was going on. Lots of great daily reporting. I mean, they didn't get into everything that now we're starting to understand, the scale of the profiteering that was going on, that's starting to become more apparent. The favoritism, the crony capitalism, that's all stuff that still remains to be fully understood and may never be, because 1/6 took the gas out of the impetus, I think, to really dig into this criminal behavior behind what they did, and the unnecessary, even Deborah Birx admits, unnecessary deaths above 100,000 that happened. So we're talking between 400,000 and 800,000 unnecessary American deaths.
It's a staggering thing. One of the first people I had on the podcast was Catherine Eban, who wrote the series.
Terrific.
Oh my God. So good. About Kushner, and that guy, just pure straight up evil, just straight up evil. And it boggles the mind how somebody could be that psychopathic and still function. I want to get to the book. I want to get back to the book because, in fact, let me go back to the book.
Well, you're in the book because Kushner's Eban, I reference Eban's reporting in that chapter. I mean, Eban's reporting is foundational to understanding what Kushner was doing. And it's foundational to understanding the Trump administration's ideological underpinnings and the strategy for dealing with this crisis. It's one of the pillars of what they were relying on, which is this you know, vulture capitalist ideology that they had and that Kushner lives and dies by. So that's, I mean, the assistant that I had working with me, one of the early things I had her do was not just the science. I said, would you go in and like, just go through all of the, I gave her some subjects and I said, just go through the the history, the daily reporting, and kind of give me a timeline of what order these some of these things were happening in. And she wrote me back after the first day or two, and she said, "I feel like I'm being pelted with WTFs all over again." I felt like that should be like the book, you know, should be at the front of the book or something. I think I do quote her in there somewhere saying that, because it was WTFs every single day, every day for months, right?
And in real time, it's not like we had to have distance from what was happening to understand that WTFs were being deployed. It was real time. Everybody knew it, and there wasn't a damn thing we could do about it. So one of the reasons, and I think you alluded to it earlier, one of the reasons this book is so valuable as a resource is that it has the timelines in it. And it's so important, I think, in general, to just keep going back to the timelines, keep reviewing the timelines. I mean, one of the reasons why I started writing columns in the way that I do is just that, just for my own, you know, because stuff gets forgotten, it gets glossed over. When you have this fire hose of news and fire hose of corruption like we've had, little things slip through the cracks, and it's so damn easy to just forget. I wonder tactically if it is a good idea to do January 6th first. I wonder if tactically it would be a better idea to do the COVID investigation first and then go to January 6th, just because it's harder for them to push back on that, I would think.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Greg. And I think the House is, you know, they have that, they have a subcommittee looking into the whole thing. It's Clyburn's, it's a subcommittee of the health, it's a subcommittee on the pandemic. And they're the ones who are digging up a lot of things. I mean, they're the ones who dug up the emails from that Redfield tried to hide when those two flunkies who were running the HHS and the overseeing communications with the CDC were just willy-nilly, you know, redoing the data and, you know, casually talking about how they could, children should all infect each other right away. Remember that?
Is that Caputo or is that somebody else?
Yes, Caputo and Alexander. Yeah. And then Redfield trying to deep six those emails. The subcommittee found that, but they've also been, I just talked to them the other day because I just wrote an article for The Nation, a Tom Dispatch will be syndicated next week or so, maybe later this week, about who can we look to for, who's looking into this? Where is the, who's asking for accountability in an official way? And the GAO is one. The COVID COVID Act created something called the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, and it's the IGs of all these different agencies, and they're pretty nonpartisan. Michael Horowitz of the FBI didn't actually fake the info about Russia.
Yeah.
Michael Horowitz report. He's heading this thing. And they're looking into it, but I looked at what they were all doing, and I concluded, at least as far as I can tell, that this subcommittee in the House is really the one that's going to dig up the big, they're going after the big fish. They're looking at these gigantic multi hundred million dollar contracts that were just not bidded out, you know, sole purchaser stuff. And they're all like little tiny company in Herndon, Virginia, got to oversee the SBA emergency loan program, something like $60 billion, tiny little company, obviously well-connected to, you know, Trump had never handled anything like this and predictably completely fucked it up. So they know, although they can't actually get all the money back, they know that like that it's riddled the emergency loan program riddled with fraud everywhere they look. Billions of dollars of American taxpayer money that was meant to go just being ripped off, and no accountability for those people unless, you know, the House subcommittee hauls them in, and then you get sort of public shaming, I guess. But whether it goes next to a court, hard to tell. You know, like everything with the former administration, it's, you know, the his MO all of his life was to find loopholes in the law and really, really just beat the American legal system down. And I'm not sure that they will be able to come after them, but at least they can publicly shame. And obviously which would be better to have? We're not going to get that bipartisan 1-6 commission, right? But we may get, if they are smart, we may get some daily hearings from some committee on television, like the Benghazi. This is like, it's like 101 politics, that they're, that they haven't set that up yet, that Pelosi has not set that up, that they're not putting up the visuals that they had in the impeachment trial every single day. Where are the political strategists that they're not doing that?
I don't understand.
So I don't know which should come first, that or showing people, look how badly and deliberately, malignantly, they handled this emergency. And it wasn't an accident. It was not accidental chaos. It was deliberate, and it could have been prevented, and any other leader would have been a different outcome.
Yeah, no, and it's not just the people that died, you know, the people that died are that's a staggeringly high number, but there's people that got the disease that are living with the after effects. There's probably four times as many. I'm guessing what the statistics are. All of the impacts of the economy and on people's lives. I mean, people's lives were thrust through this strange, horrible experience for the last year, which the opening of your book talks about with the Defoe. Is that a novel or a memoir?
Yeah, no, it's a back in those days, I guess nonfiction and fiction were kind of blended together, but it's more of a nonfiction than, say, Moll Flanders was, his other great novel. It's an account of a plague, the plague hitting London some years before Defoe was born, I think. And he's recreating what was happening, but he based it on actual accounts, I think. So it's nonfictional. I mean, he's got a character who's obviously a fictional character. The narrator is an I, but he talks about things that the way that the city closed down and how the rich got to leave and the poor had to stay there and how they were in lockdown and how people fled from lockdown and went mad running in the streets because they didn't want to be locked in. And then all of the crank cures and the astrologers and everybody just came out of the woodwork. I can protect you. You're here. You know, we'll protect you. They wore dead toads on their collars to ward it off. I mean,
that does work though.
It does.
If you get the right kind of toad.
I'm so glad that I read that early on because I kept one close to me. And I really think that's why when I went to the grocery store, I never got it.
It's true. It's true. Nobody went near you because they were like, oh my God, there's a toad on your, Wait, now I was going to say something and now I completely lost my train.
Well, you said Defoe, we starting with the way that we haven't actually changed in our response as a species to this kind of event. But that's kind of another part of the story, and it has to do with the vaccines and the medical sort of response to it, which we could talk about. I mean, science actually triumphed against this tide of anti-expertise, anti-science, defrauding leadership that we had.
It's really
clearly there wouldn't have been enough. I know that people are walking around now saying, well, maybe this would have happened anyway. You see things going wrong in Europe, and you can see that this might have happened anyway, but you also see it going right in other places. I don't think that if we had a leader who listened to science early on and who respected it and who said, we're going to all wear masks. I know the WHO and the early scientists, the early doctors were saying, no, don't bother. But they changed their mind. And when they changed their mind, they needed a powerful leader to come up and say, I trust this decision by the science. This distrust of science, there's a long lead up to it in our country, right? It goes back to the merchants of doubt. Naomi Oreskes has written about the tobacco industry, the sugar industry, saying, sugar doesn't, no, those scientific reports about obesity, they're wrong. Sugar's good for you. Similarly, tobacco. No, cancer, not lung cancer. No, keep smoking. now we have, of course, the climate change thing, which is, again, they find these people to trot out. Some of them have PhDs, and it's all this junk science, and they spew it out. And all it does is it's very effective because it just keeps people thinking, well, those PhDs, they don't really know what they're talking about, you know, and nobody really understands or has explained that to people that science is a process of experiment and understanding, and, you know, they're working towards the answers. And so sometimes they're not 100% correct, but you have to trust that they're going in the right direction. And the way that you understand that is, and this is the part of the book about the vaccine history and vaccine creation. It's, you know, Greg, if you and I were born in 1900, we would not have gotten to this age without having watched siblings die or get very, very sick of infectious diseases, or even if in the early 20s, up until the really a lot of vaccines were being mass produced, even children of ours. If you're born in 1900, you would have witnessed children and, you know, your own children dying of diseases, the names of which we can't even pronounce, because science invented these over time, over many, many years of trying and making mistakes and then trying again. They created these this protection for us and making, you know, the creation of our antibodies. And it's only been 250 years that this human race has had any kind of protection against these infectious diseases, any kind. Only when they, with smallpox in the late 1700s, when they figured out, okay, if we put a little bit of this lesser, this other type of pox that's very weak, the cowpox, if we put some of that on your, inside your system, you won't catch the smallpox. And they didn't even really understand why it worked. They just realized, well, it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. So that was sort of the basis of vaccines. But that's 250 years, Greg. And before that, for the entire history of written and unwritten human habitation on this planet, we did not have any kind of protection. Now we do. And we're very spoiled by it. We're very spoiled because we no longer have even a conception of what those 15 vaccines that they're giving our little babies, what they are protecting us from. We don't even know.
It's really staggering. There's so much that sort of blows my mind about all of this stuff. You were talking about how they trot out these PhDs with the junk science. And I think it is very effective because most people don't know anything about infectious diseases and our row numbers and whatever genetics, you know, anything
especially
like that.
Not genetic.
So when you have two different competing scientists that appear to be on level playing ground, pretending like it's medical crossfire, you know, it's human nature to throw up your hands and say, okay, fine, I don't understand. It really is. And we're going to talk about the vaccines in a second, because that's a whole thing. And I think it's really interesting. The thing that surprises me the most about this whole thing, I think, is that Trump put Pence in charge. Remember that day? I'm sure you mentioned it.
Oh, yes.
It's the other guy was back there. Azar, is that his name? The guy that was it.
Yep.
He was there, and it seemed like he actually kind of had it going on. He at least had prepared and thought it through, because he looked like, in my mind, and maybe I'm just remembering this wrong, he looked like he was ready to go up to the podium and start talking. And Trump just completely, you know, did a 180 and pulled the rug out from under him and said, we're going to have Mike Pence, the guy that started the HIV pandemic, you know, the mini outbreak in Indiana and rural Indiana, because he hates Planned Parenthood and gay people. He's the guy that's going to be in charge. Maybe he can take the applied wisdom of his failure in the state that he governed and put it to work here. What boggles my mind, I get that Trump and Kushner are thieves and they're going to just do what they do. They're mobsters. That's what they do. When Pence is in charge, there's every incentive for him to succeed. I tweeted it. I'm like, look, I know this guy's a joke, but the incentive for him to succeed here is so high. Maybe he will. Maybe he'll just take the reins and go to town. And of course he did not. And I think that's one of the biggest WTFs that I can think of, is like all of these smart people, presumably reasonably intelligent people, just didn't do. All you have to do is ask Fauci what to do and do that, and then talk to people every day at 11 o'clock like Cuomo did.
Right.
It's not rocket science here.
So yes, the other part of that first part of the book. Okay, so we've talked about chaos capitalism and the ideology of, you know, profit, shareholders first, and, you know, profiteering, the stuff that Eban has covered in Vanity Fair with Kushner. That is one idea, as I argue in the book, that is one ideological pillar of power in the Trump administration. What's the other power pole that got him elected? Remember, the white evangelical Christians, right? Without which not, sine qua non. The minute he got in, first of all, you know, he didn't want Pence. He wanted a buddy, like he wanted a mobster buddy, like somebody like who could talk, you know, Goomba talk, like Chris Christie. He didn't want Pence. I mean, remember when, I mean, that's all another story.
Tom LoBianco wrote a great book about it. Yeah.
He put Pence in there to pay back, to get the votes. Okay. Yep. Once in office, they immediately did something that I don't think anybody else really noticed, that I think I understood. They immediately started to pay back the white evangelical Christian community by going into the public health agencies. Why? Alex Azar, you say he looks like a kind of a normal guy to you. I didn't realize until very late in the process of writing this, he's a hardcore Christian, white Christian evangelical who was the sponsor of Ralph Drollinger's cabinet Bible study weekly classes in the White House. The founders would have been rolling over in their graves. That's who Alex Azar is. Okay. Alex Azar Redfield is a white Christian evangelical. He's into AIDS because of the moral stuff. Burks got in. Burks is a real doctor, but Burks is also a white evangelical Christian who cut her teeth on AIDS and was interested in it. They were in the moral. They're involved in it for moral reasons, right? Mm-hmm. So when they look at the public health agencies, that's who they decide to give those, you know, those agencies to the white evangelical Christians. Why? Because they can use HHS to pay back these people who want to police morality, right? They can go at those. So what they did at HHS was right away. This button was on the website until Biden came in. On the front page of their website, there was a religious liberty button that you could click on your computer, and you could go into it and say, I don't want to sell contraceptives. I don't want to serve abortion. I don't want to serve transgenders and gay people in any medical way. And they would come out and assist them. The US power of the federal system would come in and help those people. That's what their eye was on, Greg. Not, they were policing morality at these agencies. They were not focused on a virus might come and kill hundreds of thousands of Americans. So when the virus starts to roll in early in January, February, March, there's this whole community of people in this country who are expert at dealing with pandemics. That's all they do. They think about, they statisticize, they're studying it. They're studying pandemics here and they're studying epidemics. I'm sorry, they're studying epidemics everywhere. They know what they're doing. And they literally, they have this community. It's been written about. They called it the red something, this email chain that they were all on early on. You know, they were dealing with this crisis amongst themselves. And they were trying to figure out, who do we call in the CDC? Who do we call in the HHS? Who do we call in the administration? Hello, who do we call to tell them, you know, no, you know what? We didn't just round the corner as Trump was saying in March. You have to do X, Y, and Z, and you have to do this in this order. They didn't even know who to call because attrition, they had gotten rid of people and they didn't put them back in. And remember, I mean, the first thing they did was try to dismantle the agencies. They wanted those people out of there. They wanted those, right, you know, those insiders have to go. It's the deep state. So, you know, they did things like incredibly fired all these physicists from the Energy Department and put in some buddies of Eric Trump's, right? Energy Department, they're in charge of nuclear safety, nuclear weapons safety.
Are you saying that Eric Trump's friends can't handle nuclear weapons? Come on. And why would you need this? Why would you need this mailing list of experts when you have Jared Kushner's college roommate? Come on, Nina.
Exactly. I guess I'm just not, I'm not privy to the special information that they had or thought they had, but they did think that they could handle it. And they, you know, those were the people who were in charge, right? Adam Baylor, I think that's his name, roommate of Kushner, in charge of the PPE COVID task force. And all they were doing was cronyism and cutting deals with cutting contracts for people because there was an emergency. They could go around all of the contracting rules in the federal government. And again, we go back to where's the accountability? Who is likely to reveal where this money went and try to get it back, or at least shame and name people? I don't think it's ever going to go beyond that. Maybe, you know, maybe the House, in conjunction with the GAO or this PRAC operation, maybe they're going to actually extract back some of that money. But, you know, it wasn't actually, obviously, it's not all about money. It's about how badly they mishandled it. And they mishandled it because they had gone after the agencies early on. They wanted to smash the state. They didn't want to have government. They're anti-government ideologues. And they wanted to prove the private enterprise, private industry could do better than the FEMA. I mean, that's the bottom line. The privatize everything. And
let's hope that one thing that comes out of this is that nobody ever makes that fucking moronic argument ever the fuck again.
Well, I would like to believe that that could happen, but I very much doubt that when they get the House back in 2022, or if they manage to get the Congress back and they put somebody like Nikki Haley in as president in 2024, you will be hearing that same jargon all over again. It'll be writ new. They'll say it in a different way, but they absolutely have. That's their interest, right? The interest is to shrink government, to shrink it, but to also help your friends.
Well, it's
also since you have your hand in the treasury and the piggy bank, to help your friends in private industry and enterprise.
It's the logical conclusion of capitalism in its purest form, which you can only exploit so far until there's no more people and no more earth. I mean, not to be anti-capitalist, but there needs to be controls on this shit, and it needs to change a little bit with the time. And these guys are not interested in that. They're dinosaurs. Ronald Reagan saying that the government is the problem, not the solution, or whatever he said in that inaugural address, is one of the worst things anyone has ever said in the history of this country, if not the entire of all time ever.
Yes, it's good to remind people of that, because people have forgotten, or they think, oh, he was just that nice cowboy actor and he had such a smooth way of talking. And look, he got, you know, the Russians, the communist threat went away thanks to him, right? Remember that?
Oh, yeah, and, it went away, sure.
Okay, right. And they named the Washington airport after him. And then now he's like the Republicans' god, right? He's their god. And so you kind of like let them go with that. And no, they should be reminded every day. He destroyed this country the unions were destroyed by nothing. He was the vulture capitalist smiling actor face.
Yeah. No soul, no very baseline intelligence. Most of the problems that we're now dealing with deregulation. The whole idea, you know, that government is bad and that regulation is bad is also stupid. I mean, in the rah-rah times of the late 19th century, when like Standard Oil was doing its thing, all of those railroad companies, they banded together and colluded to have some regulation because they wanted it. They recognized that for the businesses to function, they needed it to happen. Those big monopolies actually compelled the government to react, because the only thing big and powerful enough to act as ballast to these huge corporations was the federal government. And when Hoover was president, he was sort of did what Kushner said. Kushner echoed Hoover during the meetings for the pandemic, talking about, well, let's the states figure it out. It's not our job. Da da da. That shit was, we knew that was bad news in 1930, man. I don't know what you're talking about. So That's what I mean. These are stupid ideas. They're thoroughly debunked. And if people still believe them, that's on our side to not educate everybody to these important points. Okay. I always forget to do this. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about vaccines and the history of vaccines. So we'll be right back with Nina Burley.
There is a world beneath our own, created over a century ago by America's original gangsters, Meyer Lansky, Lucky Luciano, Al Capone. And it was infiltrated almost immediately by the world's most formidable spies. The new podcast, The World Beneath, illuminates the untold 100-year history of mobsters and spies. Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows.
Okay, we're back with Nina Burley, author of Virus, Vaccinations, the CDC, and the Hijacking of America's Response to the Pandemic. Part of your book is about vaccines and what they are and how they came about and all of these diseases that they, you know, stop us from getting. So I've often argued that the single greatest thing about being alive now, the way that we're alive, is vaccines. I don't know what number two is, but that's number one by a country mile. So,
well, it is true. I mean, antibiotics obviously are important as well, but I'm a secular person. I'm not a religious person. And I think that these are man-made, especially these things they've just invented, are man-made miracles. People should really, really appreciate what medical science has done. The advances in medical science over the last 200 years have only increased in magnitude as time goes on, orders of magnitude, so that by the last two decades, you have this understanding of genetics that enabled and has enabled the creation of this vaccine that is going to, the mRNA vaccine, that is going to be the platform for many, many other life-saving, epidemic-stopping, infectious disease-stopping vaccines. For people to say, well, I'll wait a while. I don't know if it works. I don't know if I trust this. You know, it's just so important to remind people that, again, we talked about this before, but that, you know, we don't know what we don't, what isn't hurting us because of science, because of these vaccines that were invented first in the late 1700s. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. They didn't understand why it worked. They just knew it worked. And then slowly into the 1800s, as lenses began to be ground up in Holland so that the human eye could begin to see tiny, tiny things. Only then did human beings begin to understand, oh, there are these little tiny things that are killing us. This is the enemy. They started to look at the blood, the guts of cholera victims. And there are these little rod-shaped things in them that we don't see anywhere else. What is that? And then they started seeing tuberculosis. I'm not telling it in the right order, but, you know, Louis Pasteur is famous for, you know, making great strides in this. But there were a lot of people, a lot of scientists in that era working in disparate areas in Europe who began to understand using these newly available tools of a microscope that now we have electron microscopes. Just so you imagine, like they were using your glasses, Greg, ground up a little bit more, that's all they had at that time. They didn't have that before. And they used, you know, it's like, I call it steampunk laboratories. They had like gaslight, right? And they tested things on themselves and some of them died. And there's this terrific book called The Microbe Hunters for anybody who's like geeks out on this like I do. And it's just this lively story of these like 10 or 15 people who during this period from the first grinding of the lenses into so the early, late 1800s, these are people who started to be able to understand what these little tiny things were that could kill us. So there's that. Those people stood on each other's shoulders over time. Many of them died before they actually saw the results of the knowledge that they had added to the base of knowledge. And that's just also moving to me that these, you know, this is human endeavor. It's human science. It's human brains. It's not the guy upstairs telling you, you know, and up until 250 years ago, that's all you had was to go look at the sky and say, well, maybe the pandemic happened because an asteroid just went by, or we saw that big star, that meteor that brought it, or, you know, the king did something bad to people. So this is the world's revenge. This is God's revenge. It was always the supernatural. This is not supernatural stuff. It's the world that we live in, and it's humanism. And we need to respect this history. So that's my big advertisement for respecting the current vaccines, which are not going to change your genetic makeup. They have nothing. They were able to make them because they understand genetic, because of huge advances in the last 20 years in understanding genetics. So when the Chinese sent the genome of the COVID-19 virus over to, well, they gave it to the world. They said, this is what it is. This is what, these are the lines of proteins, the RNA, DNA. This is what makes this virus. And that, of course, we all have heard about the spike protein, right? There's a spike protein. We've seen so many pictures of that little spike protein. Well, within 3 days of that information arriving, the scientists at the NIH had created already, they already knew what this thing was that they needed, this messenger RNA, mRNA, a little strand of proteins that goes into your body. It tells the cells with the vaccine, and it tells the cells, if you see, and I'm simplifying this extremely, if you see this shape, this spike protein, make an antibody because it's going to kill you. But the actual piece of spike protein that they've made is a 100% synthetic. And secondly, it's a transient thing. It doesn't stick in you. It just tells your body, look, if you see this, make something to reject it. It doesn't stay running around in your body. All it's doing is like, it's like telling your body something and going away. And that's what messenger RNA is. And they only know about messenger RNA because they've learned so much about genetics and how DNA and RNA work and how the genome works.
So it's called, is it called messenger because it shows up, delivers the message, and then
exactly.
It's, okay.
Exactly. And it's, so it's this little, and they, for many, many, they've known that this could be done for several decades, 15 or 20 years. But what they couldn't do, what was so problematic, was getting it so that it could get past the body's defenses, because it's alien. So the first thing they did was they figured out that they could encase it in like little bits of blobs of fat or cholesterol. And so they put it in, the solution, and the fat sort of goes, encapsulates it. And then that enables it to get into your body. And then they had to work on whether the body would, the type of lipid, whether it would create an immune reaction. And what they couldn't do for a long time was get that into the body without creating immune reactions. So in fact, they actually think that the immune reaction that people have when they have extreme immune reactions is that they're actually responding to this stuff called glycol something. It's the lipid. It's not even the mRNA, which is not, it's a strand of three little proteins. It's just, so long story short, I'm simplifying it immensely. I believe I'm telling this story accurately as I can. You can read up more on it if you're interested. But the point is, creation of this vaccine was known 3 days after they knew what the thing that they needed to make was, 3 days after they found that genome, or that they heard what the Chinese released the genome information. And secondly, it's now in people's arms 11 months later.
It's really,
we're beyond 11 months, obviously, but that went into arms 11 months later. That is a land speed record. And it means that going forward, when another virus like this hits us, and it will, they'll be able to figure it out, and bam, they will have it. You have no idea how much we don't even know, because we're not going to be around in 50 years or 100 years, how much protection we now have thanks to this invention. And, you know, hopefully some of these people are going to win Nobel Prizes in science. If they haven't, I think one guy that I interviewed did get, well, did he get the, no, he didn't get the Nobel. They're just terrific scientists, an unheard of people who just obscure, you know, toiled in obscurity for years, you know, advancing this inch by inch. And we need to respect that.
They saved humanity is what they did. And they did it at a time when the leader, the presumptive leader of the free world, was actively working against that happening. So when you consider that, when you consider that the Trump administration was basically doing much more trouble than not, it was not helping at all. The fact that they were able to come up with this and crank it out and get it into everybody's arms in that amount of time is astonishing. It's really astonishing because, as I understand it, coronaviruses are hard. The reason people get colds all the time is because it's hard to cure a cold. It's not, some of these other things are easier. And I don't know any, I'm not a scientist by any stretch of the imagination.
Neither am I. I'm an English major, man.
Yeah, me too. But this stuff is not, and it's also, I think it's not, we're going to have to get booster shots for it as it goes along. Also understand it's not a vaccine in the same way that, like, you get a vaccine for diphtheria and then you never, you know, get right. diphtheria. So but you want to talk about.
But the flu virus, you do have to update it every year, remember?
Right.
Every
the flu
year
virus
you have to
does.
Get a new virus. And that's yeah. because it's mutating all the time. And the thing right. about this one is it's mutating. And the more viruses, another thing I learned, viruses are not, they're inert. Like when they're outside your body, they're not even living really. They only live when they get in your cells. And then they're like, yay, we're alive. And they proliferate and proliferate. And so the body is like the furnace for them, or it's the universe for them. Like it's like, it enables
it's like Trump
life.
At Studio 54. That's where all the action
yes.
happens.
It's so lovely and orgiastic. And they're making more of themselves inside the body, but every body is different. And so they're changing as they're making them, you know, it's just because the more of them that can be reproduced, recreated, the more chances there are for there to be some slight glitch in the genetic message that's going down. And so that's where we get variants and variations, and the variants are going to be eluding this vaccine, and they're going to have to make a new one. And the fact that they're going to have to booster us doesn't for one second make me think that they screwed up. They absolutely did not. Go out and get your first two and get the next one. The thing is, Greg, if you listen to, I don't know, the Daily had, they went down to Tennessee on the New York Times podcast. They went down to Tennessee and interviewed people down there a couple of weeks ago who are vaccine hesitant. And it's absolutely horrifying to listen to what's going on, because they refuse. They could listen to me talk like this forever. They tape recorded them, this couple sitting there with their doctor, their family doctor, who is vaccinated and who is dealing with this community that doesn't think that should be vaccinated. And so he let the New York Times and the people let them come in and record the conversation. He's talking to them about all of their concerns and trying to put their concerns to rest. And, you know, the husband, they're older people. The wife is in her 70s. She says, well, you know, I'm concerned about, I'm older and it's such a new thing and it might make me sick. Or, you know, I don't know if in 10 years it's going to. And yeah, that's kind of a valid concern. Like, I get that, right? I actually wonder myself, like, who knows, you know, maybe, well, this is just, you know, it worked, but then like, we don't know, in 10 years, maybe we'll all have brain tumors or something. Unlikely, but you might be concerned about stuff like that. So she says that. And then the husband comes home. He says, well, I have more religious concerns.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
First of all, he thought that it was made with fetal material. And so the doctor says, no, sets him straight on that. And then he says, on his way out the door, he says, one more issue. He goes, what about the microchips? And the doctor's like, you mean the microchips that you think that Bill Gates has put microchips in this vaccination? Yeah, you know, I've heard quite a bit about that. Now, this guy is a retired engineer. And the doctor says to him, well, here's what I would say to you about the microchips. The needles that we give vaccines through are very, very, very tiny. And microchips could not possibly fit through them. Like, think about a microchip and then think about this this needle that we're injecting this with. And it's physically impossible for this to happen. So they go on their way, you know, and it sounded pretty convinced. And a few weeks later, the Times calls them up and says, "So what did you decide?" And they say, "You know, we're not convinced. We're going to wait a while." Like, this is, and these were, and this guy was an engineer who, you know, it makes you kind of want to go, "I might never drive over a bridge in Tennessee again." That's an engineer. And he doesn't get that this, like, there's this impossible spatial thing that you can't actually fit a microchip into a needle.
It's such a weird thing. Like, because I know people that are smart people that won't get the vaccine. They've created excuses and conspiracy theories and lie narratives that they tell each other, but it's just baffling. Anybody that's like anti-vax, I say, you know, next time you're at your computer, Google diphtheria and read about it.
Yes.
Just read about diphtheria. So what happens when you get diphtheria? Usually your child gets it and the tongue gets coated with the diphthers, right? Which is this coating, and it starts to coat the tongue and coat the throat, and the coughing starts and it happens, and then it stops happening because there's so much coating that the kid can't breathe anymore and his face turns blue and he fucking dies. Exactly. That happened all the time in cities all over the world for as long as there were cities. We mentioned at the top of the show, my ancestry, I happen to know that the first Oliars that came here from Eastern Slovakia came to New York City, and the first kid they had died of diphtheria in 1890 or whatever. You know, this is something that happens. It just happens. It happened to every family. Everybody had this stuff. So for some person now living in today's day and age, the ignorant arrogance to I'm good. I don't need that. Is just mind-boggling. Somebody would come... You know, if you could go back in time to the mother who lost a child to diphtheria, I want to send these people back there so that mother can beat them with an umbrella or something, you know, take out the frustration and rage, because it's just stupid. So you have to have some amount of imagination to understand, hey, we could get this terrible disease and now we don't get it anymore.
Is it a lack of imagination? I don't understand. You know, I don't, it's an absence of historical context. It's an absence of appreciation for what happened before we got here. And they don't, you know, and my goal when I talk about this book is just to make that point as clear as I possibly can, that this is something that you should respect and that you should understand as a community act. Taking vaccine is a community act. It's a social act. Again, the more of us vaccinated, the less variants are going to be sprouting up and the less work you're giving to the scientists to make more of this stuff and more of it and more of it and more of it. You know, I mean, there are a lot of problems with the way our medical system works, obviously, huge ones. And I talk about that also a little bit. But this was one of the great triumphs, and it is something that Americans had a big hand in. And the Trump administration threw money at these companies and said, you will not be held liable. I mean, I think they took the litigation issue off the table. If it doesn't work, we're still going to pay you. It's a win-win, you know? And so they did that actually right. They did put the money up for it. It was because they brought in these pharma guys, you know, like Moncef Slaoui, and a lot of everybody on that commission was big pharma. And they proceeded to respond to this in the way that they understand the business of big pharma to operate. Now, there could have been different ways to do it. In theory, they could have said, we're going to take this, you know, take advantage of this moment of crisis to reassess the profit, the shareholder value model of drug creation. And we're going to say, you're just going to do this for us. And here's the NIH, which invented a lot of this stuff. They don't get those scientists aren't getting a patent on it, but you know, we're going to do this as a government project, but it was a government, it's a government private industry project that actually did work. And I think we should appreciate that as well. I mean, they did put up, they put up the money for this. These companies were not interested in making vaccines because in the 50s, the polio vaccine was the last, well, there have been many mass vaccinations projects since. Obviously, we're getting 15, or babies get 15. But in the 50s, there were these polio outbreaks. Again, another thing, we don't even know what that is,
yeah,
right? I mean, our, I see people in one generation above us, Mitch McConnell dragging his leg. He had polio. That's what they, I had a colleague, a British journalist friend of mine, who's just drags his leg all the time. He was born in the 40s. We don't have it because we were, but they made mistakes with that vaccine. They put it in, they had an industrial project to make a lot of it, and they gave it to different factories, and one of the factories kind of screwed up, and whoops, some live virus got in. Now, all vaccines up until the mRNA are based on this attenuated virus concept that goes back to the cowpox. That's the other reason why this is so amazing. They got better at attenuating and weakening it, right? Mm-hmm. But it's always the real thing. And this is a completely different thing. It's a synthetic, and it's not the virus. It's just a, it's a message of the virus.
I didn't realize. Anyway, that. Long story short, it's like a hologram. It's like a hologram.
It's a hologram.
It's like amazing. Princess Leia saying, "Help me,
Obi-Wan." It's quantum. It's quantum, and I'm telling you, it is a new era. But the polio vaccine—they messed up. They gave kids polio, and that mistake resulted in a huge change in the American legal system, where product liability became a really, really big issue. You didn't have to do a lot to prove that the companies had done a, made products, were liable for the products that did harm. Marvin Belli, the great plaintiff lawyer, was the guy who put this together. And ever since then, these large, large companies just stopped doing it. I mean, there were only like seven companies making vaccines, and partly that's because they're not profitable, because it's all about profit with big pharma, and they're not profitable because they have to, they're only used once.
Right.
They have to make a ton of it. A lot of people get it, and therefore a lot of people on the margins, people have a little reaction to it, or something might go wrong. So liability times, you're not making a profit because you're only using it once, as opposed to an expensive cancer treatment or something that keeps your kidneys going. You know, if you're old, all of those things are profit making. This stuff isn't. So they had left the business. So that's another reason why, you know, they had to throw money at these companies and give them huge incentives. Again, because it's profit sharing, profit motivated medicine. And you saw the reaction was the CEOs of these companies and the shareholders, the big shareholders, when there were releases about, oh, clinical trial shows 95% efficacy, they literally were timed to stock sales. People got super rich off of these things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Old habits die hard, I suppose.
I don't think that habit is going to die. And you know, this is something that, this was a moment where, I don't know, I think they could have used it. And that this is again why I think the Trump administration did not want government getting involved in doing too much, because they didn't want people to understand that, oh, well, health government can deliver healthcare. Look, we can deliver healthcare now. We're getting our free vaccine, which the Biden administration has done.
Yeah.
And if they, but it's only in the vaccine sort of world. It's not in getting, you know, free medical care if you have a heart attack or if you have to go to the doctor. So it's not moving the ball on national healthcare that much, but at least it's making people understand, if those who do trust vaccines, that, hey, we got this for free. And you know what? It can work. The government can be effective in stopping something like this. And that is exactly what they didn't want you to understand.
Yeah, because the government is not the problem. The government is the fucking solution. That's the solution. The vaccine was super well organized here in New York, where I went. I went to Kingston, New York, to a Best Buy that had gone out of business, and they repurposed it into this vaccine center. So it looked like an airport from the outside, from the inside. You came in, you have your ID out. I should have brought a suitcase, you know. Okay, first shot, second shot, go here, go there. But I was in and out of the second shot. I was in, I walked in the door and I had the shot in my arm in 3 minutes. Yep. It was incredibly efficient. And that's the government at work. You know, that's the government at work. That's what we want. We want smart, responsive government getting shit done.
And getting shit done. That's that should be their motto. Getting shit done. And they need people to, and you know, I mean, that's the Biden. I mean, we back into the politics, the strategy thing. I mean, I understand what they're trying to do. You know, if they throw a lot of money into infrastructure and other projects and this COVID relief stuff, maybe they can win over some of these fascist friendly, disaffected voters that they seem to think they need absolutely to have back. But I still think they could do that and still run COVID or 1-6 hearings on a daily basis with TV cameras showing the video of the insurrection every single day.
I think we're going to have to do that. I would like to see us. I would like to see, I don't know if Merrick Garland ever wakes up from whatever coma.
Yeah, what's going on with him?
I don't know. Everybody speaks very highly. Glenn Kirshner loves the guy. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt here. I've spoken highly, but so far, there has not been enough communication. There has not been enough indictments. There's not been enough movement. And maybe Bill Barr fucked that place up so badly that he's just trying to clean up the mess. I mean, you know, sometimes you go in a room that's just a disaster, and where do you even begin to the cleanup process? I mean, maybe that's part of it. I don't understand why they can't just have a special counsel, a special prosecutor, a Mueller-esque prosecutor just to do COVID. Why can't we have that? That seems perfectly appropriate. We need to know what happened. And one thing that the American people do not like, especially the people that don't like to pay taxes, i.e. the conservative libertarian types, is government cronies stealing their tax money.
Right.
I think that's kind of an unpopular thing. I thought initially when Trump got elected that if we were able to show how much money he stole from people via, you know, his golf trips and this and that, that people would eventually clue in and get pissed off. But obviously that never happened.
Oh, you know, Greg, I did stories on Trump U over and over again. I interviewed people who had been harmed, who had been really seriously harmed, and wrote about it over and over again. And so did many other journalists. This was not hidden away. I mean,
no.
Maybe there needed to be more on TV because people don't read, but this was not, you know, I disagree when people say, you know, the media fell down on it, did not inform the public of what this man was. I totally disagree with that. I think we were on him. We were showing what a con man, what a thief he was. And throughout the summer of 2016, this was not something that was not known. So, you know, what did they do? They voted for him anyway, because they hated Hillary, because, you know, they had a bad candidate on that side, I guess. And they voted for him, and people stayed home, didn't come out to vote for her. But anyway, it's too late to litigate that all over.
It was the same thing as the men's basketball final gold medal at the 1972 Olympics. The wrong side won because the Russians cheated. That was what happened. In all seriousness, when we say the media, I think there's two things that I think what I'm talking about when I say the media is not the journalists on the ground, the reporters, because the reporters have been excellent. The Mueller report, I wrote a book in 2018 about Trump and Russia. And then a year later, the Mueller report came out and basically confirmed everything that was in my book. And I'm a novelist. I'm not a journalist. I got everything that I got from good reporting. So yes, there was reporting on the ground, but the pundits, the editors, the headline writers, Jeff Zucker at fucking CNN, and obviously this Fox News, so many people watch this garbage network. And the whole idea of equal time and the blurring of news and entertainment. Yes, the information was there, but it was just overshadowed by basically, you know, the White House apprentice show or whatever you want to call it, the joke that was made at the time. So it's just ridiculous. Anyway, but I think that if we can get a commission, a special prosecutor to go in and look at the COVID stuff, I think that would be very effective because it would have subpoena power. And these people should go to prison. Honestly, if Jared Kushner profiteered from this in any way, that Slenderman motherfucker should spend the rest of his life in jail. I mean,
I think he profiteered more off of you know, the Middle East potentate, you know, the getting.
How many
getting
laws does he have to break before we indict this guy? I mean, he's been breaking laws. He lied three times in his SF-86. Put him in jail. I don't understand. And then they keep ignoring it. And then the crimes get worse and worse and worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, I don't know. All I can say is this administration, the Trump's whole life, but especially the last 4 years of it, are just one long advertisement for how deeply vulnerable the legal system is in this country and how we don't even understand that. And I guess if you're, you know, maybe I've just been white privileged, you know, throughout my life that I actually think it works. And I wasn't, you know, a brown person driving around and get pulled over, shot dead, or more likely just picked up and thrown in jail and not able to get out for a long time because you didn't have the money. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the more common thing than cops are shooting people, but it's more that why are all these people in jail for like not having a taillight, you know? Yeah. And that's not stuff that we've experienced. So I guess in a way I had kind of a rather, the opposite of a suspicion. I kind of was naive about it, I guess, and I, you know, and I've covered the law and I've seen how, you know, it works, but I think that the extent to which it's been manipulated and ignored or, by this group of people, by these thieves and their enablers, as you say, the Russians are, it's very disturbing and profoundly problematic. And that, you know, that Merrick Garland isn't jumping up and down out there doing stuff about it. I mean, that, you know, again, let's go back to the whole, you know, when we elected them, I thought, you know, they have got to understand this is an emergency. They have to seize the reins that they've got and kick that fucking horse of power and ride over these people and pack the court, make three new states.
Right. You wrote about that. Yeah.
I mean, pack the court and make three new states right now. Like,
yeah.
And throw the filibuster out the window. And, you know, do the things that they would do. They would do that.
Yes,
you know,
they would.
Mitch McConnell has basically abused the Senate for years, used it and abused it. And, you know, it's just unbelievable that these guys don't know how to use, they've forgotten how to use power or wield power, or that I guess they're just so, I feel like I've written this. I think they're hypnotized by the process, They're it's all about process, and they don't go outside the rails of that and like step back and go, no, they're not even following. The other guys aren't even following those rules. So find a loophole in the rules the way they do and flip this around. Because if you don't, you literally are leaving our children with a dictatorship coming up. I honestly think, in 20 years or 30 years, forget it. It may be sooner, but it won't be pretty at all.
No, it's dire and it's urgent. And I don't know what it will take for them to get it through their skulls. I really thought that Joe and Kamala got what was happening. And maybe they do. Maybe they needed to do the vaccine first. They still have time. Maybe they have their strategy. I don't want to get too pessimistic yet, although I'm starting to worry. It's June now. You know, it's June. It's no longer January. It's been almost 6 months. Let's go. You know, where are the indictments? Where's the change that we need? We need to gird the Mitch McConnell gamed the system, and he gamed the system for the 1% that he does the bidding of. It's time for somebody to strike back for the rest of us. And I know Biden understands that. I think the infrastructure bill is trying to do that, and the Rescue Act is trying to do that. But they need to protect it too. They need to put safeguards in place so that they can't come, you know, just kick the kickstand over and knock over the bike. That's the one thing that Trump did that I think worked, and I think we should emulate, which is he came in and said, oh, we've always done it that way. Fuck that. We're not doing it that way anymore. You know, and it turns out a lot of this stuff is just habit. And as you said, process, it's not law. It's not in the law to do X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. So do that, Joe, do that, but for the forces of good, you know? That's it. So, okay, I'm going to end on a hopeful note, which is that, you know, the Black Death wiped out a third of the population of Europe between 1347 and 1350. And right after that, in Florence, the Renaissance started. And it started because smart people there were like, you know, we prayed to God and we kind of nothing happened. Maybe we should kind of like think about alternatives to this shit. That's what happened. So my hope is that out of this crucible of this quarantine for the last year, that every person in this country and really around the world has had to deal with, and everybody's dealt with it in their own way. And some people took to it and some people didn't. And everybody had problems and had their life altered in some fundamental way because of this quarantine, whether, you know, they just were stuck inside or they couldn't graduate in person or they lost a loved one or whatever, right? I hope that people can take that experience and have it change fundamentally in a good way what they seek coming out as we reopen, as we take off the masks, as we reemerge as a society and go back out into the sunlight. I hope that we don't do the same shit that we did before. Yes, that we don't forget.
Well, yeah, I'll just let me finish on that note. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've written a lot about the forgetting, you know, our forgetting of the Spanish flu and why that is and why we have these urges to forget this, where we memorialize war dead, but not the, you know, pandemic dead. And then this forgetting of the miscreants and malignant criminal behavior behind this pandemic itself. But an optimistic way to end this is, in addition to the vaccines being completely new, and we know humans before this generation have ever experienced this speedy of a creation of one, we also are the first generation, Greg, to have been able to see in our hands with these things, mm-hmm. that every single human being on the planet was experiencing the same thing at the same time. It's a species-wide event. Yep. And if that doesn't help us become more collective-minded, then I don't know what will. But I think that in the most optimistic take from this could be that you're saying that something should change, that people will recognize where our universal species vulnerability. And that kind of collective behavior or thinking is so needed because of climate change.
Yes.
Right? And other things that are coming down the pike. And our planet is small now that we have so many people in space. And it's going to be smaller and smaller. Anyhow, I know this sounds really Pollyanna-ish. I am from the Midwest. But that's my kind of sense of if transformational change is possible, that it somehow comes out of that and directs towards collective behavior.
I hope that it does. Now, and you mentioned astrology before. So here, the age of Pisces going into the age of Aquarius, right? Remember the whole song, The Age of Aquarius?
Yes, I know it's the age of Aquarius.
The new age is the age of Aquarius because the
are we in it right now?
The wobble of the earth moves from Pisces to Aquarius over, I think it's every 2800 years, something like that. So people are dead when it happens. And it's all arbitrary anyway. No one knows exactly when it is. I wrote a thing once arguing that it was when Facebook launched, but the age of Aquarius is an age of collective good. It's an age where all connected.
Great.
And it's an age where we're not talking about individual stuff, but we're looking outward collectively to take our knowledge and rise it to a higher level. So,
well, that's great. I'm an Aquarius, so I feel comfortable in this.
This is your age, Nina.
New age.
Okay. The book is called Virus, Vaccinations, the CDC, and the Hijacking of America's Response to the Pandemic. It's really good and really necessary, and I hope everybody goes out and buys it. Nina Burley, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sophia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signadella, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
WMedia.